EKU history professor Jackie J is here with the second installment of our monthly series about the centennial of ratification of the 19th Amendment establishing women's right to vote.
Over the next few months, we're going to be looking at historical developments in the 19th century leading up to that significant moment. And today, I'm joined by one of my colleagues in EKU's Department of History, Philosophy, and Religious Studies, Dr. Josh Lynn. Josh is a specialist in American political thought and political culture in the 19th century. And we've asked him here today to talk about the very notions of constitutional rights and citizenship. Today, we take for granted the fact that citizenship serves as the basis for an individual's right to vote. But it hasn't always been that way. So, Josh, I'd like to start by asking you to describe for us how people thought about rights and citizenship in early America. Where did rights actually come from?
Yeah, thanks, Jackie. Yeah, you have it right. We often assume today that citizenship comes with all this bundle of rights, and that a citizen has all the rights. And one of those rights is the right to vote, is suffrage. But like you said, in the 19th century, there was a very different conception of both citizenship and rights. So there was no nationally defined notion of citizenship in the 19th century or before the Civil War. The states themselves defined citizens, not the federal government for the most part. And the rights that came with citizenship thus varied by state. Individuals could be citizens and not have certain rights that other people who were not citizens did have. And so there was no necessary correlation between the status of citizen and a set list of rights that that citizen had. And a great example of that is white women were citizens, but in many states could not vote, while some white men who were not citizens could vote. And that would be, for example, white men who were immigrants not yet naturalized. So there was no strict correlation of citizenship, rights, and suffrage. And rights, duties, privileges, obligations to the government varied not just by state, but even by locality. So there's really sort of a haphazard patchwork in the early American Republic through the Civil War of status. People could have a variety of different statuses based on their position in society. And those rights, there was no right that translated across the entire country necessarily.
Ah, so there's a broad difference, and different localities, as you say, determine rights differently. And it's not tied to citizenship, the right to vote. So then who did have rights, and specifically who had the right to vote, and was voting even considered to be a right? You've mentioned white men versus women. How does that play into it?
So even though there was this heady rhetoric of natural rights coming out of the American Revolution, there was no notion that anybody inherently had a right to vote in the late 18th century and into the early 19th century. But gradually, suffrage was expanded dramatically in the first decades of the 19th century, so that by the time of the Civil War, all white men in almost every state had the right to vote regardless of their class status, regardless of their taxpayer status or their property holding status. So what does emerge is a notion that there's at least one group in society that does have a natural right to vote, and that is white men. But that can still be regardless of citizenship. And the politicians who really put forth this idea that, yes, there is a natural right to vote on some part of the population, white men, was the party of Andrew Jackson, the Democratic Party, really embraced this idea that there is a natural correlation between status and voting rights, not citizenship status and voting rights, but the status of white and male. And that status brought with it a natural right to vote. So once again, you still have a situation where white men who were not even citizens could often vote, because Democrats especially would enfranchise them before they had attained citizenship status if they were white men who were immigrants. And so by the time of the Civil War, most states had full white manhood suffrage, and all but South Carolina had popular election in presidential elections. So it's quite a expansive notion of democracy for white men. It's the most democratic polity in human history up until that point. At the same time, what emerges as a corollary to this idea that these white men had a natural right to vote was that some people naturally did not have a right to vote.
Ah, so that's fascinating that white men, even without citizenship, were the ones who considered themselves the proper voting parties in the United States. So then as other groups, the disenfranchised groups, women, white women, and then black people in general, were fighting for the right to vote, how did they position themselves against that?
This notion that white men had a natural right to vote had a certain bundle of rights that came with their status of their race and gender was not held by everybody, obviously, in the antebellum United States. So that this was a contested notion, although for much of the antebellum era, this was the Jacksonian Democrats were a leading force in politics in defining what rights were. But there were other ways to define rights. But what you do have is a situation where white men's rights develop and the franchise is expanded for white men, usually simultaneously with the restriction of rights for others. So in states that did have voting rights for African-American men, in the few places where women could vote, well, you often had occurring with white male enfranchisement or the expansion of their franchise was simultaneously disenfranchisement of black men and women or the imposition of property qualifications for black voting. And these are not coincidental. They are actually mutually reinforcing processes. And there was always opposition to that, often from other political parties. White politicians could oppose this, but most obviously African Americans themselves, women themselves, especially in the early women's suffrage movement of the mid-19th century.
So when we think of black people gaining the right to vote, black men, that would come post the Civil War, before the Jim Crow era. And so they had the right to vote, but then that was gradually infringed upon whether they could actually exercise that right. But the notion that there were women in certain states, and you're speaking of before the 19th Amendment, that there were certain states where women could vote and then that right was taken away, as was that a federal movement from the Democratic Party?
So none of this was done at the federal level. All of this was done on a state-by-state basis. So you have as a series of constitutional conventions in every state or new states coming into the union with new constitutions prescribing suffrage requirements. And usually these constitutional conventions democratize. They both democratize state government, the amount of elected officials, how accessible government was, but they also democratize the franchise for white men. But many of these constitutional conventions at the same moment disenfranchised black voters if that was a state in which African Americans could vote. And in the one notable state where women could vote, that was New Jersey, that right was also eroded for women. So these are parallel movements, white enfranchisement for all white men and black disenfranchisement on a state-by-state basis.
And so then as women are beginning to fight for suffrage, I know there are differing justifications that they are offering. If white men are saying we have the privilege to vote by virtue of the fact that we are white men, what claims can women make against that?
Right. So what you see is that because there was no consensus of where rights came from, not everyone bought into the Jacksonian Democratic argument that white men had natural rights, including the right to vote, because of their status as white men. Because not everyone bought into that, there's still a variety of ideas of where rights, where privileges come from. Sometimes voting was not even reckoned as a right. It was seen as a privilege. And because of that, there's different ideas for still who could exercise it based on what qualifications. And so sometimes people argued that suffrage should be a privilege based on your virtue or your morality. And so some female claimants to suffrage would have argued that their morally superior position as Christians, as wives, as mothers, as the guarantors of virtue in the domestic sphere entitled them to suffrage. So they would make a very gender-based argument that their status as women, as the more virtuous sex, should lead to their enfranchisement. Some took a much more gender-neutral, more feminist position that as individuals, they had the right to vote as all individuals should. They were not making an argument based on their gender or the supposed virtues inherent in their gender. And then perhaps more insidiously, some women, especially later into the 19th century after the Civil War and in the early 20th century, argued that if they were white, they should be able to vote, especially in a country that had enfranchised after the Civil War black men, that there's no excuse then to allow to have a situation where white women could not vote because their race made them superior. And of course, these are a variety of arguments for women's suffrage, but it just goes to show that the idea of rights and privileges could be based on different rationales.
Yeah, and I know that this was, as you say, a state-by-state development. And so each state had to ratify the 19th Amendment on its own, and the culture and the different attitudes in different regions of the country would impact the kind of justification and rationale for that ratification. And that's actually something we're going to be looking at with future speakers on this series. So I'm excited to dig into that deeper. So you've delved a little bit into the really wide range of notions of citizenship and voting rights. And we've talked a little bit about the justification for women to then have the vote. But why, if you were to sum it up in a nutshell, why would you say that these changing notions of citizenship and rights is so important to understand that moment in 1920 when the 19th Amendment was ratified?
It's really important to understand how one group in society has rights or privileges or duties in relation to others. So the Jacksonian idea that white men had rights by virtue of being white men was bound up with the idea that other people did not have rights by virtue of who they were. We often have this idea about how American history has unfolded in this very progressive fashion, that one group has rights and it just takes a matter of time for the next group to get those rights, and we've just gradually expanded. And the franchise is a perfect example of this. We have this one narrative of American history where every group eventually gets the franchise. The franchise just gradually expands sort of on its own. It's a force that just naturally grows with American democracy. But what's important to understand is that at different times in American history, certain groups have had the franchise because other groups did not. So there was no idea of a natural expansion, just waiting for the next group to be able to be added to American democracy, because many times those who had a certain set of rights, especially voting rights, saw the extension of that right as undermining the right that they already had. And so they were not able to conceptualize an expansion of democracy. In the era of the mid-19th century, Democrats believed that they had perfected American democracy by enfranchising all white men, and that any expansion of the franchise would destroy the republic. So they had no room in their minds for any sort of progression of democracy. They'd already done it. It was over. And so understanding how the franchise actually unfolds in a very contested way, and it's not preordained that it will unfold and that more people will be enfranchised, that is why it's important to understand the inner workings of the process.
I want to take it to a personal level. My interest in the 19th Amendment is obviously shaped by the fact that I'm a woman, and you're a historian who happens to be a man. So for that half of the population who falls into that category, why do you think this is an important thing for us to be discussing in 2020?
It's important to understand, as a man looking back at American history, how men often exercised privileges and rights because others did not, and would point to their natural rights, their natural equality, in reference to what many saw as the natural inequality of others. And understanding that relationship is absolutely key. And that's why it's important to understand the relationships of gender and race in American political history. Also, patriarchy functions in really insidious ways. We all know that, but it affects everybody. Scratch the surface of patriarchy and you realize that everybody's implicated in it and everybody suffers from it. So this rhetoric of all white men, for example, having natural equal rights, that often was true in the political realm. All white men in Jacksonian America, Civil War era America, had the equal right to vote, had the equal right to hold office. But that right rarely translated to economic equality or social equality. So in the antebellum South, the average poor white farmer had the same political rights as the slaveholding oligarch, But at the end of the day, that wasn't real equality. And so, but the idea that they were equal and were therefore superior to all other people undermined the ability of white men in the past to build alliances with people who had similar social disabilities or economic handicaps, women in the population, African Americans, enslaved Americans especially. And so patriarchy can put forth ideas of equality among certain groups that mask true inequality that affect everybody.
Ah, fascinating. And I think that provides us with a really useful lens through which to view many current events today. So that brings us to the end of our time for the second installment of our 19th Amendment series. And we really hope you'll join us next month when we're planning a tie-in to March as Women's History Month and the events coming up at EKU.
EKU Professor of History, Jackie J. So what are